Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Celia Hatton, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 13th of July, these are our main stories. A new low for U.S.-China ties. The two giants are targeting each other's officials with direct sanctions. One of the world's richest football clubs, Manchester City, succeeds in lifting a ban, allowing it to play in the European Champions League. And we hear about the millionaires asking governments to increase their taxes. Also in this podcast...
Now the UK has left the EU.
Time for us to get going.
To seize new opportunities as we transition to our new relationship.
Get moving.
It's been said again and again that Brexit means Brexit. Now the UK releases details about what its exit from the EU might actually mean. We begin with another new low for relations between China and the United States. Less than a decade ago, the two global giants pledged to establish a new model for great power relations. Things have changed radically since then. A blistering trade war and military tensions continue to threaten the lives and livelihoods of people around the world. And now, a new front line in the U.S.-China dispute. Beijing announced it's slapping sanctions on four American officials. Those individuals were responsible for pushing through U.S. sanctions, targeting some of China's top party members last week. Punishment, Washington said, for placing up to 1 million Muslim Uyghurs into detention camps in China's far western Xinjiang region. That infuriated China, which vowed payback. And today, China's foreign ministry spokesperson announced the details.
The U.S. actions are a serious interference in China's internal affairs and seriously violate basic norms governing international relations and severely undermine our bilateral relations. And China opposes strongly and condemns that. In response to its wrongdoing, China has decided to impose sanctions, starting from today, against the U.S. Congressional Executive Commission on China.
Let's turn to our Beijing correspondent, Stephen McDonnell, for more.
In fact, there's been a series of tit-for-tat reprisals over recent weeks between Washington and Beijing. For example, earlier last week, the Trump administration announced sanctions for those who are responsible for alleged human rights abuses in Tibet. China then responded and said, well, we're going to have our own sanctions on those who we think are acting not in an appropriate way on the subject of Tibet. Then, a couple of days later, we have the same fight over Xinjiang, and the US government has said that those who are responsible for putting mostly ethnic Uyghurs, hundreds of thousands of them, into these re-education camps, well, they are going to have their assets frozen in the United States and also not be able to get visas to travel to the US. Now, crucially, they named Chen Changguo, who's not only the local Communist Party chief in Xinjiang, but he's also a member of the 25-person Politburo, which oversees the whole party. This is a very senior person within the party here. And so Beijing promised there would be a response, and here it is. They've named Senators Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, Congressman Chris Smith, and also the Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback, as the targets of Beijing sanctions. Now, they haven't specifically said what that would be, but they've said they're reciprocal. So I guess presumably it means if they have any financial connections with China, any money here, then they would lose that and they wouldn't be able to get visas to visit the country.
Stephen, does this mark a turning point in the deterioration of relations between the two countries? I mean, the United States also has sanctions on officials in North Korea, for example. Does it now place China into this category?
Yeah, I think in recent times, anybody who's been watching the relationship between Washington and Beijing can see that it's totally collapsing. I mean, Last week I was speaking to some Chinese foreign ministry officials, and often they're sort of upbeat and diplomatic about these things, but they're just shaking their heads. And I mean, I asked them how long it would take to repair the damage. They had no idea whatsoever. You know, they're at a bit of a loss in a way. I mean, we had the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, last week sort of calling for greater cooperation between the world's two superpowers. I mean, but at this time, I mean, you just can't imagine that that could take place when you've just got, I mean, look at all the fronts they're fighting on. South China Sea, the coronavirus, journalists in both countries, trade war, and now we have these human rights allegations, tit-for-tat personal sanctions. It's almost like they hardly have a front at the moment that they're not having a fight about.
Stephen McDonnell. Few people would ever ask to pay higher taxes, but a group calling itself the Millionaires for Humanity, a crowd that includes 83 of the world's richest people, has done just that. It's asking governments to increase their taxes and the taxes on other members of the wealthy elite to help pay for the economic recovery from the COVID-19 crisis. Who are the people in this group? I asked our correspondent Theo Leggett, and will they get what they want?
You may not have heard of a lot of them, but there are some big names on there. So, for example, Richard Curtis, the film director responsible for movies like Notting Hill and Four Weddings and a Funeral, he's on there. Abigail Disney, a descendant of Roy E. Disney, the co-founder of the Walt Disney Company. She's a documentary maker in her own right now. She's on the list. And Jerry Greenfield, who co-founded the Ben & Jerry's ice cream chain. He's on there as well. And these people are saying not only that they should be paying more taxes immediately, substantially and permanently, as they put it, to help rectify the economic damage done by the COVID-19 outbreak, they want other rich people to do the same. And that's key because, you know, there are a lot of dollar millionaires in the world. There are a huge number of them. But what this list is notable about is that it doesn't have many billionaires on, and those are the people who could really make a difference if they wanted to. As for whether these people will get what they want, they can themselves pay more taxes if they want to. Governments are very happy to take more money from rich people, and most governments do have some kind of mechanism to do that. Certainly we have here in the UK, they have it in the United States as well. But where voluntary systems have been set up to enable people to pay more, very few people actually do. So the message here is we're prepared to pay more. We want other people who are wealthy to do the same. And that's the difficult point, because very wealthy people, as we know, have a lot of power, a lot of influence. They're good at lobbying politicians, and they can also afford expensive accountants who can help them minimize their tax burdens.
Britain voted to leave the European Union in 2016, but what that really means for those inside and outside the UK is still a mystery to most. A UK government-funded advertising campaign has started today with the aim of clearing up some of the confusion.
Now the UK has left the EU.
Time for us to get going.
To seize new opportunities as we transition to our new relationship.
Get moving.
It's on our hands now.
So we've got to get started.
Truck drivers,
tech entrepreneurs,
engineers,
fishermen,
farmers,
lawyers, makers,
holiday makers,
creators,
big business, small business, travelling for business.
We all need to plan ahead.
Check the guidance, make the changes, and let's get going.
So, will people finally know what leaving the EU will really mean? I spoke with our London correspondent, Rob Watson.
I mean, ironically, I think a lot of Remain campaigners would say that a lot of this ad sounds like exactly what they were warning about during the 2016 referendum, that, you know, from taking your pet to getting auto parts to Europe, everything about the UK's relationship with the European Union is going to be more difficult. Now, of course, the government, which is pro-Brexit, would point to what it sees as advantages, this idea of more trading with the rest of the world. But again, even on that, there's precious little detail. And at this point, certainly no new trade deals with the sort of big countries. I think that the bigger issue really is how do companies adjust? Because there was a recent survey that suggested, I think, that only a quarter of British businesses, pretty staggering, only a quarter of British businesses thought that they were ready for the new relationship, whatever that might be, with the European Union of January of next year.
Could things change if the UK works out a trade deal with
the EU?
Perhaps a little bit at the margins, but not in a major way, because don't forget, this is a government in the UK that is very much committed to a much more distant relationship between the UK and the European Union. So whether there's a trade deal or not, I mean, there is going to be much more friction in the way in which Britain trades with the European Union and the way in which people just go about the sort of things they got rather used to, which is going on holiday, living for long periods in Europe, and of course, taking your dog or perhaps your cat there.
Rob, we're also going to be hearing more about the UK's plans for a post-Brexit immigration system. What more do we know?
So what we're looking at this point is the detail, because we've already had the broad picture before. And again, it's connected to Brexit. And what this government wants is an immigration policy, as they would see it, that's based not on where you come from, so no more free movement from the European Union, but what you bring. And also, it's quite clear that what they want to do is to essentially cut down in a big way on low-skilled, low-paid immigration into the UK. Now, what we're going to hear about today is exactly how they're going to do it.
Rob Watson. It's been 6 weeks since a black man, George Floyd, was killed by police in the U.S. state of Minnesota. And in tribute to Mr. Floyd, one man has just completed a cross-country walk to the site of his death. Peter Goffin reports.
From Huntsville, Alabama, to Minneapolis, Minnesota, Terry Willis walked 1,500 kilometers through spring rains and summer heat to see the spot where George Floyd was killed. The 35-year-old set off on the 2nd of June after watching a video of police kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck for more than 8 minutes. Mr. Willis has said he's not an activist, just a black man, a father, who's been arrested in the past and who could have ended up like George Floyd. "I felt I needed to do something," he said. Mr. Willis stopped along the way at spots where other black Americans have been killed by police. At Breonna Taylor's home in Kentucky, where she was shot by officers this year. And on the street in Missouri, where police shot Michael Brown in 2014. On Sunday morning, just outside Minneapolis, Mr. Willis set off on the last leg of his walk, joined by hundreds of people.
"I feel great. I feel good. I feel all the love, I feel all the support from my people right here, right now. I've never felt this, and I feel it right now."
When he finally reached the memorial to Mr. Floyd, crowds chanted Mr. Willis's name as he got down on his knees to pay his respects. Terry Willis started his journey alone. He ended it surrounded by Americans, desperate for change.
Peter Goffin. The United Arab Emirates is expanding its ambitions in space in the coming hours with its first mission to Mars, a project that could boost scientific understanding and also the UAE's standing in the region. The Emirates Mars project, named Al Amal, meaning hope, is due to lift off from a remote Japanese island, Tanegashima. The mission has a narrow launch window of 3 weeks, during which the Earth and Mars are relatively close to each other. The BBC's Middle East business correspondent Samir Hashmi reports from Dubai.
A video showcasing ambition of a mission that began in 2014.
On July 15th, 2020, the first Arab mission to another planet will launch.
6 years after it was announced,
the HOPE probe will begin its seven-month-long journey to Mars.
The United Arab Emirates is all set to become the first Arab nation to launch an interplanetary space probe. Powered by a Japanese rocket, the orbiter named HOPE will travel to Mars on a journey that will take 7 months to complete. The objective is not to land on the red planet, but to circle around it for an entire Martian year to gather new data about its climate and atmosphere. I'm walking through the main control room, and this is really the nerve center of this project. There are 12 giant plasma screens here. On some of them, I can see different kind of numbers and data, which is related to the mission, and it's coming in from Japan. Now, on the day of the liftoff, some of the team members will be at the launch site, but the rest of the team will be stationed right here, monitoring the progress of the mission on these giant screens. Over the last decade, the UAE has partnered with other nations to launch satellites, but the Mars mission is its most ambitious space program. The head of the project, Omran Sharaf, believes that this venture is critical for the country's future.
This mission is not about reaching Mars. It's a mean for a much bigger objective. It's about creating the impact. The main reason behind this was to have a competitive, creative and innovative knowledge-based economy being established in the UAE.
Israel has been the region's leader in space flight, but other countries in the Middle East are trying to catch up. Apart from the UAE, Iran and Saudi Arabia have also been investing in their own space programs. Badr Al-Saif, an expert at the Carnegie Middle East Center, thinks that the Mars mission will strengthen the UAE's standing here in the region.
They want to show that they are not a power to be ignored. The UAE will ensure that it plays an important role moving forward. I highly doubt that it will allow for matters of regional importance, like signing a deal with the Iranians, go across without them having a say in it.
As the countdown for the launch begins, the nation is gearing up for one of its most historic moments. And if everything goes according to plan, then the probe will enter the Mars orbit in 2021, the same year during which the UAE will also celebrate its 50th anniversary. If the project is successful, then it will be a step forward for the scientific community. But more significantly, it may alter the power dynamics in the region.
Samir Hashmi. Still to come in this podcast.
With no prospect of concert halls reopening for the foreseeable future, Sheku Kanemason is not alone in finding new ways to reach music lovers.
We'll hear what it's like to play in a symphony orchestra when all the musicians have to sit far apart. Big news for the financial side of football. One of the world's richest clubs, Manchester City, and its fans will be breathing a huge sigh of relief after successfully overturning a 2-year ban from European club competitions. Back in February, the club was penalised by Europe's governing football body, UEFA, for breaking the rules that were designed to stop wealthy and elite clubs from overspending and ultimately dominating the leagues. But City appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, which has now cleared the club of charges surrounding dishonest concealment of sponsorship deals and reduced its fine from $33 million to $11 million. The former Man City midfielder, Michael Brown, gave his reaction when the ruling came in.
Well, you've got to look at the club. Their stance was very, very strong about this right from the outset, believed that they would get this overturned, and they've done that. It's great news. I think the supporters all around will be delighted. It's just been really overhanging Manchester City. So now the players, recruitment-wise, in the summer, not just with Pep Guardiola at the helm, the attraction of other players internationally is going to be much stronger. And Champions League is where these top-end players want to play, and now they can. So fantastic news.
Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick told me more.
Well, Celia, this all stems from an article in Der Spiegel in Germany back in 2018, which published emails sent by senior executives at Manchester City, which it was alleged showed that they were flouting UEFA's financial fair play rules by inflating the true value of sponsorship deals. The suggestion being that the bulk of the money came from Abu Dhabi's royal family, which owns Manchester City, and that's not allowed. Now, UEFA investigated, found City guilty, and issued them with a 2-year ban from European competition and a €30 million fine. Now, the club officials at Manchester City have always vigorously denied the charge, arguing that the emails had been hacked, taken out of context. So they hired a heavyweight legal team and appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Three judges heard the case, and in today's short release, we await the full judgment, which we expect in a few days. They said that the most of the alleged breaches were either not established or time-barred, because in UEFA's regulations, there's a 5-year limit in which to bring a case. So they removed the ban from European competition, but because City hadn't cooperated with the investigation, they decided a fine would be appropriate, but reduced it to €10 million.
And Alex, what does this decision mean for the wider world of football? Does it limit the power of the financial fair play rules moving forward?
Well, it's a huge relief for Manchester City, as you've been hearing, but it's a real blow to UEFA and the credibility of its strategy to limit the amount of money clubs spend so they don't overreach themselves. Although financial fair play rules have been criticised for simply maintaining the current status quo, whereby a few elite, rich clubs dominate the landscape. In a statement from UEFA, they said the regulations have played a significant role in protecting clubs and helping them become financially sustainable, and they remain committed to its principles. So perhaps not the end of financial fair play, but I think it's fair to say that at the very least, UEFA will have to look again at the rules, and today's decision could even prompt further action from other clubs who've been found guilty of breaking them. So it's not a great day for UEFA.
Alex Capstick, it's not so very long ago that we were warned that the coronavirus pandemic could have a terrible impact on Africa, a continent that has suffered from the effects of Ebola and HIV. But so far, apart from South Africa and a handful of other countries, it hasn't turned out that way. Uganda, for example, hasn't recorded a single death from COVID. Maria Nakalanda is a nurse at a general hospital in the Rakai district of Uganda.
Well, in the start, we actually panicked. We were thinking, oh my God, we are going to be the next dead people. And it turned out that over time, we stopped panicking and understood that probably this whole COVID situation is just not going to be as bad. We really haven't seen many patients of the symptoms of COVID. Like, we have the measures in place. We do have the tests for outpatients that are coming in. But actually, we've not recorded anyone. People are actually frustrated because they have been financially affected. They've lost a lot in business. They are struggling to put bread on the table. They are like, well, you're talking about a pandemic, which I have, and I'm able to go to work. Why don't you let me work? So the whole lockdown situation is like a punishment.
So why are there so few cases in Africa? Dr. Mary Stephen is a public health expert at WHO Africa, based in Congo.
We have a very young population, and the prevalence of those chronic non-communicable diseases, hypertension, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, chronic respiratory diseases, is much lower among Africans than what you will find elsewhere around the world. So this is part of the reason why we are seeing fewer cases. We have dealt with the Ebola outbreak in very difficult contexts, and we have been doing this physical and social distancing measures. So at the beginning of the outbreak, most countries did not manage any person that is COVID positive at home. So they were basically managed in facilities outside their homes to reduce potential transmission within households.
The World Health Organization's Dr. Mary Stephen. To South Africa now, where in the past few weeks, coronavirus infections have rocketed. That's putting a huge strain on the health system. And in another attempt to deal with the surge, the South African president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has reintroduced a total ban on alcohol sales. He's hoping it'll free up medical staff who normally have to treat alcohol-related injuries. Here's Andrew Harding in Johannesburg.
The abrupt move underlines quite how worried the authorities are about South Africa's health system being overwhelmed by the current surge of COVID-19 infections. There's no doubt that stopping the sale of alcohol will immediately ease pressure on hospitals, which routinely fill up with the victims of drunk driving and alcohol-fueled violence. But the government has sought to offset what it knows will be an unpopular ban with more lenient moves to open parks and limit other restrictions. It is midwinter here now. Power cuts have returned. And as the pandemic takes hold, a quarter of all COVID-19 deaths have occurred in the past week alone.
The rebel-held province of Idlib in Syria has now reported 4 cases of COVID-19. All the infected people are healthcare workers at a hospital near the Turkish border. Dr. Zahir Salul is the president of the medical charity Med Global, whose last visit to Idlib was in January, just before a lockdown was introduced.
Unfortunately, this is something that we've been expecting for some time. We had 4 cases of COVID confirmed in Idlib. All of them are healthcare workers. Half of them are physicians and the others are nurses. It's worrisome because when you have healthcare workers confirmed, as we have seen in other countries, that means they were either exposed from patients or they exposed other healthcare workers or patients, which in Idlib, where you have huge shortage of healthcare workers, it's very worrisome. There is only one PCR machine. PCR machine are the testing machine for COVID, and the tests are usually sent to Turkey. And in the last few months, since the beginning of the COVID pandemic, there were about 1,500 or so tests that were sent, and all of them were negative. And this is the first four that were tested positive. Of course, you know, I think and many believe that there are many other cases that are not confirmed because of the low number of testing in Idlib. And this is a problem.
Dr. Zahir Salul. As the arts world looks for ways to get back on track after coronavirus lockdowns, the London-based Philharmonia Orchestra has released a series of new online performances that were recorded using the UK's social distancing rules, demanding that all the musicians sit far apart. The first piece available to hear for free features the young cellist, Sheku Kenna-Mason. Our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones has been speaking to the Black British cellist who experienced lockdown with his family in Nottingham in central England.
I have very, very vivid images when I play this opening, kind of like a sea storm with all of the waves crashing with the tremolos in the strings and the running down triplets that I play in the solo part.
Am I right, this was your first performance with an orchestra since lockdown?
Yes, it's my first performance with an orchestra since February. To hear that sound, again, the sound of an orchestra is something very, very special. And just having that sound behind me again was an amazing feeling. But it was a slightly reduced orchestra in size and with distances between each instrument, which was more difficult than we're used to. We're used to being much closer together and hearing each other much better, so we had to get used to being in contact with each other, but from a distance.
But there was no audience. What difference does it make to you as a performer playing without an audience?
You don't have the people directly there to communicate with, and of course at the end of the piece there's no applause and things like that. We kind of all applauded ourselves, which was really, really kind of sweet.
There'll be an empty auditorium when Sheku Kenna-Mason and his sister play at the Proms this year, but he will finally be performing in front of audiences at a series of drive-in concerts at outdoor venues across the country next month.
People will arrive in their cars and be in their own kind of designated spaces such that it's safe, and I'll be performing on a stage kind of outdoor and amplified. And so it's certainly different to anything I've done before and what I'm used to doing in terms of performance. But it'll be really, really nice because there'll be people I'm performing to.
With no prospect of concert halls reopening for the foreseeable future, Sheku Kenna-Mason is not alone in finding new ways to reach music lovers. As well as appearing with the Philharmonia Orchestra, he's been live streaming performances with his family from home. But in the longer term, he says, it's not the answer.
It's difficult to charge for a stream because people are so used to accessing these things for free when it's online. And so I don't think that would necessarily be a sustainable way to work, because as musicians, people need to earn money as well as share their art with people.
And you had a birthday in lockdown. What was that like?
Happy 21st birthday, Sheku.
The birthday was fun. We played lots of table tennis and my mum cooked some nice food and we had a dance in our living room with music. It was fun. Not the kind of 21st birthday I would have predicted, but it was special and certainly a memorable one for different reasons.
Rebecca Jones speaking with Sheku Kenna-Mason. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Celia Hatton. Until next time, goodbye.